The following podcast may contain mature themes and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome. The No Fear Friday edition of the No Fear Project podcast. I'm your host, Pete D'Amico. Today, we have a conversation with Louise. Louise has a fear of change that she has learned to control, if not conquer. Her story is compelling, especially in that she uses tools from one part of her life, endurance sports, and applies them in other situations, like during a time of challenge or change. One thing that I admired during our conversation was her ability to utilize silence. There are several silences in the podcast while Louise thinks through her response. Given our modern world's emphasis on immediacy, silence is rarely used, but it is an effective communication tool, and I applaud Louise for using it. To honor her, I have left those silent gaps in the audio. I believe it gives credibility to our answers. Okay, we will be back with our talk with Louise right after this quick word from our sponsor, Silver Fox Athletics. If you are anything like me, you have big goals. I really wanted to become a better runner, and you guessed it, fear was stopping me. I needed a running coach. Enter Coach Andy in Silver Fox Athletics. I started working with Coach Andy, and he produced the perfect customized training plan. His plan and support were just what I needed. The fear started melting away instantly. I ended up with a shiny new personal record in the half marathon and even conquered my biggest running fear of all, the 26.2-mile marathon. Coach Andy specializes in those middle and back-of-the-pack runners like me, and even those that have never run much. Get more information about Silver Fox Athletics at silverfoxathletics.org. Also, follow Silver Fox Athletics on Instagram. While you are there, click book to get your free initial consultation with Coach Andy. Make sure to tell him you heard about Silver Fox on the No Fear Project. Now we are back and over to our discussion with Louise. Louise, thank you for joining us here on the No Fear Project.
Thank you so much, Pete. So my name is Louise, and we were talking a little bit about fear of change. I'm about to leave a position that I've worked in for 8 years, and the timing is a little unfortunate, having given notice at my job and suddenly there was 3 days later a plague. So I'm kind of launching into the unknown, and that certainly is anxiety provoking. So I guess I'd like to talk, when we get going, about, I guess, fear of change, and specifically about fear of the unknown. One thing that I found earlier in my life was that training for increasingly challenging sports events, in particular long distance bicycling, became a really potent way for me to gain courage in my quote unquote real life as well. So I'd like to talk about how, you know, maybe even just as a way of giving advice to myself in the moment, how to begin to recruit some of my sports learning to help me manage my fear of change in my professional life.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think we're going to learn a lot about that. Let's start a little earlier, though. Can you trace back at all in your life, has fear of change or fear of that unknown always been an issue, or can you trace it back at all?
I guess I would say that I have often had some self-limiting beliefs that I didn't necessarily think I was, you know, good enough or competitive enough in work situations to get a job. And I guess from the outside, a lot of people seem like they really are very polished and they have it all together. And it's not until, you know, maybe my fourth or fifth decade that I begin to realize everybody is tremendously insecure, and some people put up good fronts. But, you know, I guess my insecurity and my looking at other people who seem to have it all together made me think, okay, well, you know, I'm not as good. I'm not as marketable in some ways. So I think in that case, it's really hard to try to take a leap, and feels a lot safer to stick to things that are familiar, things that you have the most experience with, which means not moving forward, not advancing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had not thought about self-doubt or your own insecurities being the limitation to the fear of change. But I guess that makes a lot of sense, because if you don't know what's coming and you don't have a lot of faith in your own abilities, mm-hmm. then that change becomes nearly insurmountable.
Mm-hmm. That's key.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when did you start to get involved with endurance sports?
Yeah, so it was actually in my early 30s. And just to say, like, as a teenager, I discovered bicycling and went on a few organized like long bike tours through the, I think one was through Hostelling Association, one was through a local Y. And I was amazed. I grew up in a city, and all of a sudden we were out in the countryside, and I was seeing things and smelling things and seeing, you know, even like roadkill of like animals I'd never seen in the city, and landscapes, and just finding so much joy in realizing that as I would go up climbing a hill, that I would feel it in my lungs and in my legs, you know, and that it was a real kind of like integration of the terrain into my body in a way that I found so beautiful. So you know, I had those experiences as a teenager. In college, I became quite sedentary. I put on a lot of weight. I took up smoking and pretty much did that from college into my early 30s. And I'm a singer. And one thing that I noticed, especially from smoking, was that I could no longer sing a full line, that I'd have to stop and take a, what they call sort of cheating, you know, to stop and take a breath, before finishing singing a line. So at age 32, I quit smoking, and which was horrible. And I vowed that I'll never do that again. So far, I haven't started again, which is good, because I don't know if I could manage quitting. Better to just not start again. But I really wanted to rebuild my lungs after quitting smoking. And I remembered how much I loved riding a bike when I was a teenager. So I took an old heavy mountain bike, and I went 1 mile, and that was about what I could handle. And the next time I went out and did 2 miles, and then I picked a very small hill to see if I could get up it, and after a lot of tries, I could get up it, and I guess basically just from there began trying to keep pushing myself a little bit, and feeling very encouraged that I could make progress, and feeling my lungs healing also from that, then I guess at some point I got a lighter bike and began seeing what kind of distances I could do. And I guess a few years later, I decided to really go for it. At that time, I was living in the Pacific Northwest, and there's amazing bicycling opportunities there. And I actually I made myself like an agenda of 5 years of increasingly difficult goals. And even the one for the first year, which I think might have been the ride up Mount St. Helens called the Tour de Blast. So I don't remember if it was, you know, maybe a 50-mile ride, but an incredible amount of elevation. Even that first year goal, I really had no idea if I could handle that. And then my goal for year five was what they call the Ramrod, the ride around Mount Rainier, which I think is 156 miles with 10,000 feet of climbing. And I don't know, a little vague on some of the in-between ones, but I think year four was to be able to do the Seattle to Portland ride. They call it the STP, which is 200 miles in one day. So notice I say that that's the year four goal, because the Ramrod, shorter distance, but with so much climbing, was more difficult. So year four was a double century, and then year five was this, you know, major mountain ride. But I really had no idea even how I was going to approach what, you know, in retrospect was a more modest challenge, the Tour de Blast. So I understood about training, which was that you put the event, you open your calendar, you find in the future where the event itself is going to be. And I think this is probably common to running as well, that you, about 2 weeks before the event, you're looking to see if you can do about 75% of the distance. And if you can, then you say, okay, good, I'm prepared. Okay, so that was 2 weeks before the event. And then the idea is to increase by gentle increments, no more than about 10% of the load each week. So I work backwards on my calendar to put that in place. And, you know, so let's say I found myself in February with just a modest, you know, 20-mile ride to do. Did that, fantastic. You know, the following week, slight increase, and so on and so on, until lo and behold, before the event, a couple of weeks before the event, I did kind of the test ride and thought I was not doing bad at all. And sure enough, the event came. I did it. I succeeded. My suffering was minimal. And to me, it was astounding. It was like a magic process that had happened. That I stood at one end of the calendar thinking, I just don't see how this is going to happen. And then I stood at the other end of the calendar and said, you know, here it was. I did it. And I'm not even sure that I was so aware of what happened in the middle. To me, it was still kind of magic. But I repeated the same process the next year. Again, thinking to myself, I just don't know how it will be possible for me to pull off this event that feels kind of audacious. And working backwards on the calendar and being consistent with my training. And lo and behold, you know, the test ride is fine. And a couple of weeks later, boom, you know, the event happens. It all falls into place, and it's great. You know, I don't actually remember off the top of my head year three. Maybe that was like a double metric century, like 126 miles with some elevation. And again, you know, as if I had amnesia, like what actually happened? What was the process of getting from one end of the calendar to the other? No clue. Just magic. Something happened. You know, I had a similar experience. And I think probably after 3 years of doing this, I began to internalize the concept that it's actually possible to begin with a lot of self-doubt, but to, I guess, to use some of these techniques and these concepts of breaking things into small pieces, being consistent. And I think the big thing was developing some real sense of faith, which was that I could stand at one end of the calendar without a clue of how I was going to arrive, but to think, well, it's quite possible. I don't necessarily need to have all the answers in place. I can just sort of jump, you know, I can just sort of leap forward and have some self-assurance that this process is going to work itself. I'll tell you kind of the punchline, which was there was a little bit of an unexpected happening in year four, but I'll save that for a moment. And just say that part of what was going on in my mind was that I wanted to relocate across the country in my mid-40s and put myself through a very long graduate school program that was actually going to be 6 years and put me, you know, $100,000 in debt to go into a career that I was very attracted to, and the career itself seemed kind of risky. And I had sat and really thought about it for about 10 years. And I kept trying to talk myself out of it because it seemed like a bad idea. And after 10 years, I hadn't been able to talk myself out of it. And I began to think it was time for me to move forward with this idea. And I really, in some ways, lacked the courage to take this leap of faith. And so it was actually the process in my sports life, you know, after working on my five years of goals, you know, beginning to catch on by the end of the third year that I didn't have to have all the answers. I didn't have to see everything tied up in a package at the end, that I could take steps to move forward to accomplish something that I thought was outside of my grasp, and that it was okay. It was okay to sit with a feeling that I may or may not succeed and that I don't know for sure if I will, but that I could purposefully keep moving forward without having all the answers. So it was some of these outcomes in my sports life that encouraged me in my real life. So let me just take a break here and ask if there's any, you have any questions, anything I should clarify?
I don't necessarily have any questions. I think it's very interesting, though, how you took the process of accomplishing athletic feats and then started to back it into your life and how that helped to overcome that fear of change. And what I'm noticing is that when you look at the end result, be that a big bike ride or a career change, that final product on that snapshot in time, right, that day, if you only look at that, it's always going to be too daunting. It's always going to look like an impassable mountain. But once you trust the process, basically the process becomes the norm. It becomes the way that life is lived. And that is a huge way to get through a fear of change. So I'm super curious to see how this story continues, because I think that already the lessons in here have been huge in terms of how to look at goals, how to look at life, and then how to break it down into the process and why the process is so much more important than that end result. The end result is just a reward for following that process.
Well, that's awesome. That's a wonderful segue into year four. So the plan for year four was to do the Seattle to Portland ride. And it's a huge event, which, you know, brings people from all over the Pacific Northwest, and people come in from, you know, from far away too. And it's a 200-mile ride from Seattle to Portland. You can do it in 2 days and stay over at a midpoint, or you can do it all, in one day as a double century. So, bicyclists, that are used to riding in groups, understand, like, correct etiquette of pointing out, holes or obstacles, become very aware to not pass people on the left. Bicyclists that practice good etiquette in groups have a lot of, kind of 360 degree awareness and try to be safe and try to not endanger, their fellow riders. And not everybody who shows up to an event like this has a lot of experience riding in groups. And that's how, that's what I found, very early that morning in Seattle, was that the cyclists were all over the road and four and five across and not pointing out any holes or obstacles. And, in fact, slamming on their brakes suddenly and, causing, you know, a whole ripple effect to happen through the group. I mean, this is thousands of cyclists trying to make their way through the streets. And immediately I was on high alert and I thought, this is not a good situation. And I feel like there's an accident waiting. There's just some kind of accident waiting to happen here. And in fact, at mile 21, suddenly there was a sort of a thinning out of the crowd, like it was kind of like the curtains parted, and immediately in front of me, like 8 feet in front of me, was a pileup on the sidewalk of three bicyclists, or on the street, of three bicyclists that were down. And I didn't have enough time to react. And I realized I'm gonna pile up too. So all I could do was to just take a really deep breath and to try to relax my body. Because I knew it was inevitable that I was gonna, collide with the street and potentially the metal on their bicycles. And in fact, boom, there was a crash. One of my tires blew. Long story short, I got taken off in an ambulance, with a separated shoulder. And, so I did not accomplish my year four goal. And it made me think about, is this actually infallible? This system, you know, that I've been building where I just put in the time consistently and lo and behold, as if magic, you know, I accomplished my goal. So yeah, in fact, that year four goal didn't happen. And it gave me something to think about. It actually gave me a lot of things to think about. And I thought about what were some of the circumstances and some of the conditions that had caused this problem. Were there any logistical solutions to it? I guess I would also say to people that generally people will train with buddies to do this, so you can take turns drafting. And the little group that I had was not very cohesive. And the following year, I thought, well, okay, I'll do my year four and year five goals in that same year five. And I talked to the folks that I had been training with about, is it possible, would you be comfortable for us to leave earlier ahead of the crowd? Okay, before the official start. And then, you know, at some point, there'll probably be a wave of people that overtake us, but at least we won't be starting with a mass start? And they said, no, we don't want to do that. And I began to think, they didn't actually care that much about my safety and that I probably would do better to find some other people to train with. And in fact, I ended up finding a much more simpatico group to train with that helped me feel safe. It was actually really interesting. I met this guy very randomly on a bike ride I was doing on a different event that I was doing. And he was a lovely guy. And we chatted for a long time. And at the end, I said, you know, maybe this is this is kind of like a it doesn't have anything to do with like dating. But, you know, I said, you know, I don't know if this is like a little forward of me, but, you know, we ride at the same rate. We have similar sensibilities about safety. I wonder, would you be willing to train with me for the Seattle to Portland ride? And he said, oh, I never thought you'd ask, you know, really sweet guy. But so,
not a lot of Tinder, you know, for cyclists out there.
Right. Yeah. No, it's just like, it's just sort of like meet up, like no romance, just writing companionship.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, like those sensibilities of, you know, being actually aware of safety, you know, and being able to take a little bit off of the, you know, I need to get my PR, right? That's not so much of an important value. You know, so he and I met up several times and trained together. And he told me that he actually crashed several years previous and that he completely understood some of my trying to manage logistics for more safety. And, you know, we would stick together and we would take care of each other. So it was a lovely setup. And the day came, and I think his crash site, I think his crash site came up first. So he said, okay, here, let's just stop and look at the place and I'll show you where I crashed and how. And, you know, it was, I think, cathartic for him to talk about it. And then we went on, we came at mile 21 to my crash site, you know, we stopped, we talked about it a little bit, you know, kind of put that behind us and, you know, had a wonderful experience together, did our 200 miles in one day. And, that felt like a great accomplishment. And then 2 weeks later, I did the ride around Mount Rainier, which was 156 miles with 10,000 feet of climbing. And wow, in fact, now that I think about it, I had a minor crash that day too, which was getting into a pace line with people that didn't exactly know what they were doing. At one point, the guy in front of me slammed on his brakes and I bumped into him, fell over, lost two of my lowest gears, which is a bummer when you're climbing 10,000 feet. Had a little bit of a scraped up leg, and, you know, and that was about it. Yeah, I guess you know, it's not that I could so much control things that were beyond my control, but, I think, you know, maybe especially to say on that, that Mount Rainier ride, you know, that I guess at that point I would say I had the resilience to say, well, look, I crashed. Look, I'm missing a couple of gears. Look, my leg is bleeding, but, you know, let me keep going and see what happens. And I think that's a lot of what I need is a belief system that I can deal with things that'll come up, that I will be able to adapt to, you know, difficult conditions or changes. And I feel like that's what, you know, that's what has happened for me, in my sports life. And just to say, in more recent times, I've gotten into, sprint triathlon, a friend of mine, her workplace was doing a local sprint triathlon, a bike friend of mine, and she said, hey, you want to do this? And I said, okay, sure, this sounds like fun. I'll need to learn how to run and swim. And, you know, over the years, I've learned how to run, which I almost like more now than bicycling. And I'm not the best swimmer in the world. There's been a lot of trying to figure out how to overcome, fear with the swim. And I've really gotten far with managing my own thoughts, as I swim. And I feel like triathlon is, there's something about that, which is, in particular, seems to foster resilience, because you have to do all these different things. You have to manage your equipment. You have to think about how to do transitions. It's not just the sports themselves, but also you just have to keep adapting. And I feel like that's very, very potent metaphor, that I can bring into my quote unquote real life.
That definitely makes sense. I mean, you bring up a major theme of life, which is obstacles are always going to be in the way and crashes are going to happen. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And that's with sports, that's with just life in general. And what I'm always saying to my kids, it's not that you crash, it's not if you make a mistake, it's how you recover. You know, what's going to bring you back to that time and that place and get you through it? And that's kind of where I'd like to ask. So you've got these obstacles in your sports life, and now you've got some in your work life, and you're kind of bumping up against this kind of weird intersection of time in terms of for your journey, right? Where you're looking at transitioning jobs, and it's as COVID starts. So how exactly has that cycling and endurance and triathlon, like, how's that impacted the way you're thinking about what you've got to do right now with your job and where you're going next?
So I guess I would say, as I mentioned, you know, this idea of like standing at one end of the calendar and not being able to see, not being able to even understand what it would look like at the other end of the calendar, like when the event itself came. Mm-hmm. I think that puts me in a good place, in a place of saying, I don't have answers to my questions. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. There certainly are purposeful steps I can take forward, but I expect to be unemployed or underemployed until my profession's hiring season begins, typically in early winter. And financially, you know, thank God, we can drain our savings a bit and, you know, and manage, which that's a privilege for which I'm very grateful, that we're not in a desperate situation. I mean, and I guess just another thing to say, we don't exactly know, you know, none of us know, how long the economic fallout from this will be. And, you know, at some point, if I can't generate income, we'll run out of savings and it'll be a big problem. But I'm not sure that it's that helpful for me to try to look far ahead into the future, because I don't know that there's anything I can do about it. Okay. So this is also about, like, what is a useful time frame you know, what is the time frame that allows you to, you know, to have hope and to be purposeful? And I, you know, I feel like if I said, oh my God, you know, everything like, you know, the economy will continue to be shut down for 5 years and we'll be in the street. I'm not sure if that serves me in any way. You know, I'm not sure how that sets me up to function in the meantime. I feel like it's not useful, a non-useful thought. So I just need to say, okay, whatever, and put that kind of thinking, to the side. But, really, I think it's the ability to tolerate the unknown, the ability to say, I don't know what's going to happen exactly. Okay. I don't, my questions are not answered. And I will go forward anyway. And I'll do some purposeful behavior. So I've just been thinking, during this period of time, if I'm unemployed or underemployed, what are some projects that will help me in my own professional development? There are some, you know, potential like certification trainings that I can do, which could, you know, be helpful to me and also be good on my resume. There are people that are doing particular, people that are involved in things that are particular interests of mine, and I'd like to use the time to connect with them and to have some kind of like creative synergy with other people that are working on specific things that are of interest to me. You know, some of these things may have a side effect of giving me a little bit more, you know, exposure that people can see me, which could potentially lead to a professional connection. But, you know, if not, then I will feel like I've done things that are purposeful, maybe not money generating. Would be lovely if they were, but you know, things that were purposeful in my field. The other thing somebody said to me was, you know, a lot of times people will be concerned about leaving a job and, you know, without having something in hand, in terms of a gap in the resume. And she said to me, man, you have a perfect excuse for a gap in your resume.
Yeah.
I left my job and there was a plague. Yeah. So, I thought that was funny too.
Yeah, it's not.
But I really think it's about, I really just think it's about the, you know, the ability to tolerate not having answers and moving forward anyway. And I feel like I really benefited from, you know, from those 5 years of training to just say, look, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I'll move forward anyway. And incidentally, it was that process that helped me, you know, relocate, move across the country, study for 6 years, incur $100,000 in student loan debt, go into a profession that I thought was, you know, risky. You know, so just that lesson of moving forward without having your questions answered.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think what I'm hearing is that the fear of change, the fear of unknown exists, but you've found tools and learned how to accept and, or at least accept the process. I'm going to ask, do you enjoy the process more or race day more? And, you know, by that extension, the day you get the job or what have you, which do you enjoy more?
In my sports life, I enjoy the training more than the event. But I think over time, I've come to enjoy the event as well. I think I've come to take a much more lighthearted approach to the event. And before I just in the past, I felt more pressure, on the day of. And, you know, if I'm by myself and I'm doing a training run or, you know, ride or whatever I'm doing, it's just me, you know, and then at the event, there's all of these other athletes. And I'm definitely a back of the pack, runner. I'm somewhere between mid pack and back of the pack, cyclist, and I'm last out of the water on the swim. So there's also that factor of comparing myself to other people. And just having to sort through any messages that are flitting through my mind about that. But like I said, over some period of time, I guess I've done the local, triathlon 5 times at this point. And what was interesting was that it began in the earlier days, it was, sanctioned, as a, what is it? The Triathlon Association of America. And so people would come, like competitive, you know, athletes would come and do it as a, oh, what's the word? I forgot.
Like a qualifier?
Qualifier. Yeah. As a qualifier for other events. Okay. So there was really, you know, it was maybe like 75% hardcore and 25% local people doing it, you know, sort of fun recreation fitness kind of a thing. At some point they dropped the sanction, and then it became, you know, maybe the opposite, maybe 25% hardcore folks, 75% people that wanted to do it for, you know, fitness and recreation. And I think that helped me also to just look around and see, a much more lighthearted atmosphere. You know, as we were setting up our transition area, and just the mood was a lot lighter. And I think that's helped me to just enjoy the event more and not be like worried about if I fit in, where I fit in. But yeah, I would say I definitely enjoy the training. I enjoy the consistency. I enjoy creating some structure in, you know, in my life. And really, running, biking, et cetera, is very important for me to be able to be calm and, it's very important for me to be able to be calm and be able to take things in stride and keep my perspective. And so if I create some structure where I'm going to train, you know, 3 times a week or 4 times a week, I know that I'm ensuring self-care, by being sure to get out there and burn off all that junk, that's in my mind.
Yeah, I like that. Training definitely is that way. And we've hit, as athletes, we've hit a very strange time where there are no events. So do you continue to train when there's no events? And I've seen some people fall off. I've seen other people pick it up and some people remain the same. I think it's very individual. But when you don't enjoy the process, at least as much as the event, if not more, then when the event is canceled, the incentive to train is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a delicate line, right there, or delicate balance maybe is the better term.
Well, I had wanted to do a longer format triathlon this summer. That was one of my goals. I had not actually settled on an event. I've been looking at a few and those all went away. And I gotta say, to try to do like a virtual triathlon is seems like for triathlon, it seems like you really need more infrastructure. It's a little bit more complicated. Like if you're going to swim, you probably need somebody to spot you in the water in case there's an issue. Definitely need somebody to watch your bike, you know, while you're in the water. So I just kind of let go of the idea of trying to do a longer format triathlon, like by myself. It didn't really make any sense. It just seemed a little too peculiar. But I did join a group, run coaching group and, online. And through that, I met a woman who, and by the way, I would say, I just to say I'm pushing 60. Okay. And I met this woman through that group who, she said she always wanted to try, she was always interested in triathlon and she wanted to give it a try, no pun intended. And, and that she was old. And so I connected with her and I said, hey, I'm old also. And, you know, we have this wonderful local venue here, where I've done the triathlon for 5 years. And I would be very happy if you'd like to come here. I can show you our course and I can kind of step you through the process. We could do it, if you like, we could do it sort of as a race, or we could take a little bit of a more lighthearted approach to it and don't have to push the transition times, you know. So she's been training and I've been training and, so we're gonna do this, just the two of us. So sort of like try for two. And I think we'll just swim along the shore so that we're, you know, we don't necessarily need, a lot of infrastructure. On the other hand, so I run 5K, I run 10K, and so our coach was talking to us about setting goals for the summer, and she said, yeah, Louise, I think you should run, you should train and run a half marathon. And I'm like, huh. you think that, huh? That's interesting. I've been experimenting with learning how to run slower and longer, using intervals. And I discovered the other day that, so I was using, for the first time, I was doing a 3-minute run, 1-minute walk, and it like took nothing out of me. And I went, 7.7 miles, and felt like I could have just continued in that steady state for quite a bit longer. The next day I had no pain or fatigue in my legs whatsoever. So I have been thinking, huh, okay, you know, I could actually see it now, you know. I mean, I can see from that state of being after doing close to 8 miles. I don't have all the answers tied up in a bow, but, you know, the sort of dotted line between that and a half marathon, it's a familiar looking dotted line to me. You know, I see how plausible it is given what I did. So, there is a local half marathon in the fall here. It's lovely. I've run part of it with a friend who did the whole thing. I've probably run every bit of the course in different, you know, in different routes at different times. It's interesting because it's scheduled for, mid-September, and they're going to decide on June 30th if they're going to need to postpone it. And if so, then it'll be at the beginning of November. So I'm looking at, a half marathon training plan and pretty much following it, except I'm also trying to do my triathlon training, but I have a lot of time in either case.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great
goal. Yeah.
I think that's fantastic. Well,
And I guess just the other thing to say about this discovery about finding a slow, steady state, you know, interval pace. I feel like, as a younger person, I thought that some things needed to be accomplished with like brute force, you know, and as I get a little bit more mature, I realize that sometimes it's finding this way that's much gentler and more sustainable, which is going to allow you to accomplish. So that was amazing to see, you know, I can pick this real steady interval and I could just go forever. But pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but is there anything else you wanted to add before we wrap it up?
I guess just a question, you know, I wonder if this is unusual. I wonder if there are people who have a lot of assurance in their quote unquote real life and then have to use, sort of recruit that in order to progress in their sporting life. Or I wonder, you know, if there's a lot of people out there that have the kind of experience that I have, which is to use the sporting life as a tool for development in real life.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if anybody listening wants to reach out and talk about that on the podcast, that would be fantastic, because from anecdotal evidence, I can tell you that I've heard it mostly in the direction you're talking about. And I relate to this a lot because I'll go out and do some crazy things athletically that I feel like, I don't know, I almost get like imposter syndrome, you know, about around that, because I feel like, well, I shouldn't be able to do this. I don't really belong. Yet I get it done and I really enjoy the training aspect of it. And then I've recruited those skills to try to get better at life. And, you know, your point about not knowing the answer to the questions resonates with me a lot, because I've actually gotten to the point now in my life where I'm prepared that the question is never answered. And that's, I mean, I consult. I don't have a full-time job at this point, right? So I consult and I do podcasting, and that's not lucrative, especially at this point in time, right? With everything in history, everything's kind of on hold, and I'm okay with that. The reason I put these out is to see if somebody's story like yours impacts one other person at any point in time. And if it does, then it was well worth it. And I can also tell you that every single time I do one, I'm impacted. So it's a little selfish, I guess, because I just like to sit and hear people's stories. It's why I love podcasting and why I listen to so many podcasts. So that's, you know, your question is great, because I would love to hear if other people have these similar experiences, or if they just struggle all the way through and are not finding the tools to get over the hump with a fear of change or a fear of the unknown. So that's definitely a great question. All right. Well, I think with that,
thank you so much.
Yeah, we can wrap it up. I really appreciate your time, and we'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Louise. I want to thank her again for coming on to share her fears, the tools she uses to overcome them, and for her candor throughout. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. As we wrap up this episode, I want to thank our patrons, especially our producers, Dava Sylvia, the Endurance for Everyone podcast, and the Money, Motivation, and Motherhood podcast. Your continued support is amazing. And as always, remember, the way forward is together. The time to conquer is now.
Thank you for listening to the No Fear Project. Original music is from Josh and Dean. Join us on social media by searching the No Fear Project on Facebook and Instagram. Check out thenofearproject.com for more information, including in-person presentations on fear customized for your organization. The No Fear Project is committed to helping those with mental illness get help and to defeating the stigma. If you have any thoughts of harming yourself or suicide, please contact the Suicide Prevention Hotline for help now at 800-273-8255. Remember, you are not alone. The No Fear Project is a production of Paragon Media, all rights reserved.